Hi, friends. I got some good emails and some questions following on from the last session we did, which is on violence and turning the other cheek and all that good stuff. And I thought that since some of the questions you emailed me were almost certainly other people's questions, I hope you don't mind. I'm going to answer them or go through them a little bit here as a little bonus episode for you to listen to. One question that came in, which wasn't about violence, and I thought I'd deal with this very quickly. Somebody says, I'm conscious that much of your concern and focus has been on Western evangelical Christians and churchianity, church insanity, this person writes. And I'm interested in the rise of Christianity in China and the broader Asian continent. Do you know much of whether this is a cause for joy and in line with the beautiful Sermon on the Mount, or is it a cause for further concern as it follows the line of the evangelical West? Yeah, I don't deal with don't deal with China or Africa or Eastern Europe or Brazil. I don't deal with different cultures. It's not because I don't think they aren't important. It's just that you have to. I stay with what I know, or I stay with what I think is important to my particular audience. I'm not trying to speak to all people, so. It's obviously not that I don't think these things are important. It's that I am staying in my lane, I guess. So I do focus on evangelicals. I focus on North Americans. I focus on Protestants because I am all of those things. And that's why I tend to focus on them. I have, however, been watching the movements in some of these other places. And I think you're right that there is some connections. I do think wherever you find the rise of Christianity being connected to the health and wealth stuff, the prosperity gospel stuff, the militaristic individualism, the patriotism, wherever you find that, that is really bad. And just looking at numbers is not the same as looking at the quality, right? The quantity of people is not the same as the quality. And the problems of Christendom apply everywhere. It's not just white people. And but also a lot of the most pernicious elements, the worst forms of Christianity often do have American evangelicalism as some of its motivators. And I know that sounds really harsh and judgmental. It is just my considered opinion as a student of the state of Christianity today, that some of the worst and shallowest expressions that are actually more about violence and money, they will have at their heart American missionary movements, American ideas, American evangelical resources will be pumped into them. That would be very true of places like South America and Brazil, for example, and the Pentecostalism there. Those are not forces. That is not a culture of Christianity that is leading to a whole army of followers of Jesus Christ. And you can look at, if you think American support of Trump is bad, you should look at what's happening in Brazil with Bolsonaro. But in terms of China and the Asian countries or cultures, yeah, absolutely. I think that I have seen and been witnessing some really good stuff coming out of the persecuted churches where they are unable to meet in large groups. They are unable to have a cultural cachet, and it has not been bad for them. It has been bad for them in terms of livelihood, in terms of personal freedom. It has not been bad for their pure expression of reliance on the way of Jesus. And I think a lot of observers of the Chinese Christianity will recognize that. There are different strands, though. There is a nationalistic element in China. And I have been observing some people, some Chinese Christians, trying to justify their Christianity as patriotic. So they have been trying to align their Christianity with Chinese patriotism. And Chinese patriotism, China is a notoriously racist society with a really high degree of national triumphalism going on. And you do notice there are Christian voices there that are actually supporting that and trying to align themselves with that rather than to challenge it or to be outside of it. And so, yeah, I would definitely be watching that. I do think we're not in any condition where it's not like the UK or Europe or North America where Christianity is in the foundations, in the DNA of the society. And so Christendom is going to look very different in China or Japan or Korea. There's a huge Christian population in Korea as well. It's the most popular religion. But the impact of it is slightly different. It is a different beast. And Chinese Christianity is so... I just don't know how to deal with it because it's too complicated. But if you step back a bit, the forces of nationalism which are at work in any Christian culture which has founding itself in positions of power or with some sort of cultural cachet or some sort of goods that is trying to defend for itself, whenever you find the Christians aligning themselves with the culture around them or seeing themselves as the protector of their culture, rather than an alternative to their culture, that is where you see problems. And we've seen it. We saw it with Roman Christianity. We saw it with Byzantine Christianity. We saw it with Russian Christianity. We saw it with English Christianity, French, German, American, Argentinian, Mexican, you name it. There has been a problem where groups of followers of Jesus end up becoming cultural guardians of their national heritage. And there is no reason at all to think that China would be any different to that. And that would be a live concern for Chinese Christians as well as it has been for everyone else. Another thing, what does a lifestyle of turning the other cheek... A couple of questions here about explicitly about violence. What does the lifestyle of turning the other cheek look like in terms of... If somebody was experiencing racism, would it still be like they don't respond and just turn the other cheek? So this is a little bit... These questions are about... it's all very well me overlooking an insult, but what happens when my friend is insulted? Or what happens when I'm in a situation where injustice is happening to somebody next to me, or I'm aware of it in my environment? Am I expected to just ignore the person who is racist? Am I supposed to not say anything? And this person writes, I think I'd find it easy to turn the other cheek if it's something to do with me. However, like another example... is if somebody was aiming something at my sister, I would want to do something about it. Yeah, see, so does turning the other cheek apply across the board and not just personally? If so, when does that become peacekeeping and just ignoring what's going on compared to being a peacemaking, knowing you have to have tough conversations as well that brings peace and does not just collude with other people's crap? So this is a really good question, and it does touch on the kinds of stuff we were talking about in the previous session, because I think the first thing I would say is that I'm not the best voice for this. I haven't had to practice it in my life. It's very academic for me, right? Literally academic for me. And I have to practice it in different ways. But when it comes to like actual engagement with racism, this is not an issue that I personally have had to deal with. And so I cannot speak to this with great moral authority. I've been interested in following Bernice King. She's Martin Luther King's daughter. And if you follow her on social media, she's an interesting voice. She's still very much flying the flag for this kind of peacekeeping, nonviolent peacekeeping. I'd really recommend looking her up. Look her up and then sort of follow the trail. See who she recommends. See who she's reading or who she's promoting or talking with. See the kinds of people she is around and follow the breadcrumb trail and find that. And I do find a lot of the best work in this is coming out of the people who are actually experiencing it and they're putting it into practice. I would say that first of all. And a lot of it is actually a change in mindset. You mentioned this in your question. Is it just a change of attitude that's needed? And I think what we need to have is the change of mindset, which is the Sermon on the Mount approach, the turn the other cheek approach, it's not about letting the person just walk all over you. And it's not about ignoring a thing. The mindset change is that we do not fight evil with the same tactics that evil fought us. We do not apply to our enemy the same weapons that he is applying to us. There is a mindset which says it is better to be subject to evil than to subject evil to other people. It's better to be hurt than to hurt others, if it really comes down to it. So there's a mindset there, which is that the people following the Sermon on the Mount, they are actively trying to find creative ways to deal with injustice, to deal with problems, to deal with racism in such a way that it doesn't just perpetuate those problems back again. It doesn't just lead to that cycle of violence, the endless cycle of revenge and violence and escalating violence. It doesn't dehumanize the people who are trying to dehumanize you. It's people who are really creatively trying to find ways to resolve conflicts. And they are trying to resolve conflicts. And the other thing I would say is they don't always work. And we've mentioned this many times, but this isn't like some knockdown argument for success. And that isn't the way what we're thinking here. It's just an opinion or a way of thinking that says we know that the other way isn't good. Even if it gets results, it's not good. And we know that something is damaged in humanity when people destroy their enemies. We know that something is damaged and gone wrong for humans when they give in to hate or despair or fear. And so this is an attempt. These are attempts to just not do that. And it's hard work, and it doesn't always work very well, and doesn't always succeed, but it's still good. And so this is where you get these practitioners who are saying, okay, this is just the way we're going to do it because we know this is the kingdom of God's way. And it's not that it's going to solve racism. It's not going to solve violence. But it is going to remove, it's saying like, at least I'm not going to add to the crap. I might not get away with all the crap. It might not be done with it all, but at least I'm not adding to it. And then on top of that, sometimes change does happen because this really is an effective and robust way of dealing with conflict. And the thing that we'd say with change is that when it does happen, it really happens. It's lasting. It's slower, it's less obvious than just killing your enemies, it's less obvious than shouting them down or freezing them out with votes and making sure they never have a say. It's less immediately effective, however, it's much more long-term effective when we go the route of peacemaking and peacekeeping. And so here we have the situation where you are faced with an injustice, a racist person, and your friend or your sister is being treated badly. Turning the other cheek does not mean letting that thing just happen. The turn the other cheek ethos is one where you are stopping the normal course of action and you are forcing the perpetrator to acknowledge what he's doing. You're forcing the, just think of how like society will work, in kind of the racist society is that a bully will say awful things about another group and then everyone's just silent. And if anything, the bully is rewarded by his home group for being a bully, for being a racist. And that's the kind of play that plays itself out all the time. That is a narrative that plays itself out all the time. Another narrative that plays itself out is that we are in a war between races. Black people are in an endless war against white people, and white people are going to be replaced by black people. And the white people are superior, and black people are violent and savage. And so then a white racist goes to a black person and says, "You're just a violent savage." And lo and behold, the black person then turns around and kicks and punches and fights back. And all that's done, maybe in the 10 minutes when that black person has beaten up the white bully, maybe he feels good about himself. Maybe he's achieved a little victory. But what he also has done is he's totally reinforced that whole narrative that the white racists are telling themselves about themselves. That violence is the only language they'll understand, and you can't reason with them, and this is the way it is, and they're not really human. You know, all these awful things that they say, by reacting the way that they've predicted you will react, you have not changed the script. You have not stopped the endless cycle from just rolling onwards. You haven't actually changed anyone's mind. And in fact, you've probably just created a martyr. If you beat up a white racist, you might feel good about yourself for 5 minutes, but what you've done is you've just created a white racist who hates you even more, who's humiliated, and whose friends are now going to be incensed against you. And you've reinforced all of the bad problems and ideas that those people had. So you reinforce it if you don't say anything at all and you just let it happen. And you reinforce it if you jump up and fight violence with violence, or if you try and erase from the face of the earth the person that's trying to erase you from the face of the earth. So what the turn the other cheek does is it stops the narrative from just ticking over. It puts a halt to the typical way of things going. And so I would say that definitely when you are in the presence of somebody who is being racist, you halt the script. You stand there and you say, if you're going to keep saying this, you have to say it to my face too. If you're going to say it to my friend, you have to say it to me. That kind of thing. Or you stop and you use your words, or you use your body and you say, I am standing between this my friend and your violent words. And so you're going to have to get through me if you want to get to them, or something like that. And so what you're doing here is, all that you're doing is you're refusing to use the weapons that are on offer. You're refusing to fight violence with violence. You're refusing to cause harm. And that doesn't at all mean that you're refusing to call something out, to vote with your body, to raise your voice, to lend your voice to others, to use all the resources you have to hand. There's money, there's power, there's music and song and words and politics, and there's so many different avenues that we can follow when it comes to wanting to change people's hearts and minds and systems. We can be engaged in all these different things, and pretty much all the follower of Jesus is doing is they're just saying, well, killing a human to solve a problem is off the table for us, but pretty much everything else is fair game. Or perhaps I would say destroying the humanity of another person is off the table for us, but everything else is fair game. And that would be a way. There's lots and lots of ways that people are engaged in creative ways to solve these conflicts. And then if it's applied to you personally, there's this idea, like, again, the change of mind when it comes to Sermon on the Mount stuff is are you going through life constantly like an accountant who's adding up all the times people have infringed against you and what's rightfully yours? Or are you going through life actively looking for ways to bless others, or to bless your enemies, or to forgive them? And that's the change in the switch that gets flicked in your brain, right? And so it's not saying that if you follow the Sermon on the Mount, you never will have your rights infringed. It's more aimed at people saying, like, when your rights are infringed, like, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to throw all of your resources at that problem? Is your whole life now going to be bent towards getting what was rightfully yours back again, or making sure nobody ever wins when they're involved in a conflict with you? And it's that kind of life that's just obsessed with protecting what's rightfully yours. And nobody denies that sometimes you will be taken advantage of. I mean, in these passages, Jesus is overtly and explicitly predicting that people are going to be persecuted because of him. This is not a promise that you won't be taken advantage of or persecuted. It's a map, a manual for what to do when you are persecuted, when you are taken advantage of, when you are the victim of something, this is our ways that you can be without creating even more evil in the world. It's a way to stop evil in its tracks, and it's, and it also is a way to humanize your enemy. So if you're being taken advantage of or persecuted, and then you stand your ground without being violent, and you make that persecutor really kind of pause and own their action and have to do it again. When you say, hit me again, you're making them, the first hit might have just been them acting out the script that had been written for them by their society. The second hit becomes something that they've had to do of their own free will and intentional volition. And that's what kind of changes people when you humanize them, when you make people own their own actions. And I think that's part of what's going on here with the Sermon on the Mount ethic, and that the followers of Jesus who are making something after the fact, like they're taking the principles of the Sermon on the Mount and they're saying, what can we do to build a world, or at least a course of actions that is trying to follow these ideas as closely as possible? And this is very different from the type of Christendom, which is in fact that most of us are familiar with Christianity, which is doing what it can to not obey these things and to exempt themselves. So most of Christendom, certainly the North American ones, and also Anglicans as well, like mainstream European Anglo-Christianity is in many ways an effort to exempt themselves from having to live the Sermon on the Mount. And I prefer to be with the people who are trying to follow the Sermon on the Mount, even if they get it wrong. I'd rather be around people who are trying really hard or want to live this way with integrity and honesty, even if they get it wrong, than be around people who are doing all they can to pretend that it doesn't apply to them or to find ways to justify that they don't have to live this way. And the success of it doesn't really come into it, although it does succeed at times. And you're not allowing yourself to be abused when you, as it were, get them to slap you again. That's not really what's going on, because you are also not. Remember that there's going to also be an expectation that a lot of these people are, we want them to be, either they are brothers and sisters already in the faith, and so now they are being held to a higher standard that they're being asked to live up to, which is what happened with, we've mentioned before, with a lot of the, it's how Wilberforce did it, it's how the civil rights movement often did it. They appealed to the latent Christianity already in the culture. And by acting in non-violent ways, by stopping the script, they forced the Christian population to wake up to its own professed Christianity. And it led to some changes, and as I say, some lasting changes. So there is an idea that some of the people who are doing the abuse of you will themselves call themselves Christians. And so this is an opportunity to change, for them to change. So there's an expectation that the perpetrator is not just an enemy of Christ, they might also call themselves a friend of Christ. And now this is an opportunity for them to really wake up and see what they're doing. So when you're being hit again, as it were, or when you receive the insult more than once, you're doing it not as a way to just slide into their narrative. You're doing it as a way to change the narrative. You don't just quietly let them insult you. You stand there and you say, because I am following the way of Jesus, I am going to get you to insult me again, right? This is where you look at like a Bernice King, who I mentioned earlier. Like she does her very political, very public, very engaged actions for justice. Like she's not a quiet, hiding away kind of person. She's not passive. She's not inactive. She's not a victim. She's just not violent. She's just not being horrible to her enemies, and she's telling them why, right? That's part of the protest. It's part of the, you shine a light on the situation. You say, I am going to shine a light on this situation right now. And I am going to let you, I'm going to make you insult me again. I'm going to make you take advantage of me again. Because I believe that the way of Jesus is more important than destroying you as a human. Or something like that. And these are the kinds of events that we talk about here. It's very, it's self-aware, I guess what I'm saying. It's not a cringing worm who's just folding into other people's narrative. It's a very self-aware taking back the narrative. And in a sense, like confronting people. It's a non-violent confrontation. Got another email about somebody who's living in the heart of very conservative America and is talking about the tension that the church I'm exposed to they just don't get it. That the anger, the aggression, the fear, the violence is so blatantly antithetical to the way of Jesus. And this person writes, I'm surrounded by Christians who live out a form of religious non-belief, which I think is a very good phrase. They don't actually believe. They don't want to follow the way of Jesus. If I challenged any notions of proper theology, like resurrection, the virgin birth, prayer, atonement, whatever, they would agree to disagree. They wouldn't care very much. But if I talk about guns, the military, the war, politics, then I'm labeled as unpatriotic, and that's worse than anything. Is nonviolence an essential aspect to truly walk in the way of Jesus, says the questioner. Yes. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I don't know what else to say. You are in the grip of a culture which has been generations in the making. Generational idolatry. Generational love. It's not just lesser of two evils. It's not just people who with a heavy heart engage in violence because we live in a broken world and they just don't know what else to do. These are people, as you rightly know, you are living in a culture which loves violence, which talks about it and puts it on its bumper stickers and celebrates it and gets more energized and emotionally engaged with matters of national violence and personal violence and killing than it does about anything else. These are not a culture of people who are thinking of violence as the very last resort in a broken and sinful world. These are people whose identity is wrapped up in the worship and glorification of violence. And they might be Christian, but they have absolutely nothing of the way of Christ about them. And that is very sad. But also, I don't quite know how to counsel you. I don't want to, like, say leave them, because that's a big thing to say. But I would say don't give up or unclench your own self from thinking that you are going to find the way of Christ amongst these people. Because you're not. So guard your mind and guard your heart about what people are speaking into. Guard your heart and be careful who you allow to speak into your life, I guess, because there is a lot of it. You can get quite spiritual about it, actually. I mean, I think there's we talked about the worship of Baal and child sacrifice and principalities. This kind of thing you're up against, my friend, is like a principality, a demonic structure which is literally demanding sacrifice, child sacrifice. Parents willingly sending their children off to war, to kill, in the name of their country. And principalities that demand human sacrifice in order to keep going. The New Testament calls that Gehenna, hell, Molech, the place of utter destruction and utter waste. And that's where I think you are at, or you're living around that. And I'm hesitant to say, like, come out of that, because I know that that's an impossible thing to do. But just let's be aware where you live. And I'm reminded of my friend Brian Zand, who wrote the Postcards from Babylon. And he famously says, Americans have grown up thinking that they're the city on a hill. They think they're the kingdom of heaven, when in fact they are Babylon. They're the belly of the beast. They are what the Book of Revelation describes as the great empire that is drunk on its own violence and money. And that's what we have right now. And America is not the only one. There are many, many other nations and groups in the world that are also like that. But you are an American, and that is what we're talking about right now. And America is one example of a Babylon. And it's doing its stuff in the name of Jesus. And it's bad. So nonviolence is essential. Or the refusal to decimate your enemy for the sake of solving your own problems. That is essential to the way of Jesus. It is essential to the way of the cross. It's way more than just one or two Bible verses. We're talking about the whole pattern of the whole life. We're talking about the cross, the crucifixion. We're talking about every time Jesus refused to use violence to call down fire on his enemies, or angels to kill his enemies, or his followers to lift up swords to kill his enemies. We're talking about a whole life pattern towards this. So yes, you cannot follow the way of Jesus and be an enthusiastic patriot. Well, full stop. I don't think you can be a patriot, but you certainly can't be a violent, loving person and be a follower of the way of Jesus. And the reason I say you can't be a patriot and a follower of Jesus is because patriotism does inevitably lead towards killing enemies. It's because violence and patriotism are so bound up, and that the nation that you're patriotic towards itself absolutely requires the death of your enemies. It requires the blood of other humans in order to keep going. So any patriotism to any country is love towards a human institution that is founded on acts that are the exact opposite of anything Jesus said or did. So we live in them, we try and love our neighbors, but we don't love our country, because that's putting love into something that is not good. Yeah, go read Postcards from Babylon if you haven't already, because Brian Zand is also living in the American South, and he's also around charismatics and Christians. He's also fully aware of what's going on, and he's trying to see himself. It's a mindset of, I'm living in the belly of the beast. I'm not living on the city on the hill. And that does change the way that we think about things. Which, by the way, brings us full circle back to our China point, which is that I think a lot of followers of Jesus today living in the heartland of Middle America, or living in British Christendom, followers of Jesus, not Christians, but followers of Jesus, are going to have a lot more in common than they might think with Chinese dissidents meeting in house churches who are suffering persecution. It's just that in the American Christian West, or in the Anglo-European Christendoms, the people doing the persecution are other Christians. But we have a lot in common with underground house churches. Anyway, friends, I will stop now. Bye.